Good morning, everyone. A couple minutes past time, but we'll get going here. Does anybody need the questions for today?
I do that for you, sir.
Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, come back in. Thank you.
For anyone who's visiting, we are doing a rather detailed study of the Bible narrative, and we're looking at the 17 periods of Bible history, as has been noted by Bob Waldron and Sandra Waldron in the series of books and lessons that they prepared. And we've been going through the invasion and conquest period of the narrative, and we should come pretty close to completing that today. And my thinking is to spend next week doing a review of that period. So you may be glad to hear that I probably won't be sending out questions this coming week. We're just going to do kind of an overall review next week. We will start out today in a moment by kind of finishing up the tail end of last week's material. But before we do that, let's go to God in prayer. Father in heaven, we're thankful to be able to be here together today, and thankful for your word and the opportunity to study it. As we look at the end of the invasion and conquest period today, Father, we pray that we will note some things that are fairly plainly presented to us. We pray that we will constantly, every day, be thankful for all that you have done for us, and that will cause us to increase our love for you, which in turn should cause us to want to serve you better. We pray that you will be with us this morning as we go through this study. In your son's name, amen. So last week, we were talking at the end of the class session about that altar that the people from the 2.5 tribes who were going to be living east of the Jordan River had constructed over by the river. And what a controversy had ensued as a result of their building that altar. And so here we go. The last question from last week was, why did these men of Reuben, Gad, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, why did they build that altar in the first place? What was the purpose of it?
It served as a kind of a reminder to the other side that they had access to the altar. Not to the one they built, but to the one that was from God at the tabernacle.
Right. That's exactly right. When they were confronted about it, they explained themselves this way. They said that their intent in building it had been to prevent a future claim, a claim that might be made by the people living west of the Jordan River, to the effect that the Lord had intended the river to operate as a boundary between them and the people east of the river. And they had a major concern that was stemming from that. They were afraid that the people west of the Jordan were going to adopt the view that everyone living east of the river really had no portion in the Lord. And that as a result of that, the children of those living east of the river would cease to worship the Lord. And so we see, really, the bottom line was their main concern was for generations to follow. And so as Jared noted, this altar was to serve as a reminder, as a witness between us and you, they said, and between our generations after us, that we do perform the service of the Lord in his presence with our burnt offerings and sacrifices and peace offerings, so your children will not say to our children in time to come, you have no portion in the Lord. So it's going to be a witness between the people in the west and the people east of the river. In other words, it's going to be something that their children could show to the children of the people west of the river and make the argument that they were in good standing with the Lord. And they gave firm assurance that all their offerings, all their sacrifices would be made on the altar of the Lord that stands before his tabernacle. We see that in Joshua 22, verse 29. And so the problem was solved, right? That seemed to please the people who had come to confront them. Can you think of any lesson or application from this rather unusual story that might be pertinent to Christians today? And I know it's very hard for you to have any idea what I'm driving at here, so I'll tell you in a minute. But I wouldn't expect anyone to have an answer to that one. But one thing that occurred to me was, you remember what happened when the people west of the river heard about the fact that this altar had been built? Well, they got pretty mad, didn't they? And they immediately assumed the worst. And they all gathered together, and they were getting ready to go to war just on the basis of their assumptions of the facts. Well, what turned out to be the case? Their assumptions had been all wrong. It was good that they sent a delegation to check into the situation before just launching warfare, but they found that they had been incorrect in what they had assumed. And I suppose even today, we sometimes need to be careful that we don't do that, that we wait for the facts and we wait for evidence before we just jump to conclusions about what's in the minds and hearts of others. Okay, well, let's move on to today's material. We're going to be talking about the fulfillment of the land promise that God had made to Abraham originally, and the situation that pertained at the end of this period of invasion and conquest. And you recall that Abraham had come into the land from Ur at God's urging. And this happened a long time ago, about 1900 to 2000 years before Christ. Abraham had left Ur, and he had gone to Haran, and from there he was going to go to the land that God would show him. Where this bubble is here, noting Hebrews 11, 8 to 10, is pointing to Ur down in the Chaldean area. The Hebrews passage just is a reference to Abraham's faith in doing this. And he went from there up to Haran. And the Genesis passage refers to God making the promise to Abraham. We see that it was about 600 miles from Ur to Haran, so that was not an easy trip. Wouldn't be easy, all that easy right now. Back then, it must have been a real slog. And then there was another 400 miles where he went down to what would later be the Promised Land. And he ended up at Shechem. And I think we mentioned that Shechem was where the land promise was first made to Abraham. And in Genesis 12, verse 7, we read that God had promised Abram, "To your offspring I will give this land." Well, we're at the point now in the narrative where that has actually happened. It's taken place. And I want to go back to Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 to 45. That's a short passage that I just jumped right over last week. You may have noticed that I skipped this material. And there was a reason for that. But let's look at it now. It says, "Thus the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers. And they took possession of it, and they settled there. And the Lord gave them rest on every side, just as he had sworn to their fathers. Not one of their enemies had withstood them, for the Lord had given all their enemies into their hands. Not one word of all the good promises that the Lord had made to the house of Israel had failed. All came to pass." But we know that the borders of the land that God had promised included quite a bit of territory that the Israelites were not yet occupying. I mean, we're aware of that, right? There's more than one passage describing these boundaries, and they're not always easy to follow. But the earliest one, I think, came from God himself in Genesis chapter 15, verse 18, where he said the land was going to extend from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, the river of Egypt, people sometimes assume that meant the Nile River, but I think most of the scholars now, at least the ones that I've read, think that that's not the case, that it pertained to the, what's the name of this, the Wadi El Arish, which would mark right around the southern border of Judah. So let's take a look at this. We know that at the close of Joshua's life, the land that the Israelites had settled to that point did not extend very far north of Tyre. You see Tyre there, and you can see they didn't go too much further north. And you see over here, the territory of Manasseh stopped short of Damascus. So with that in mind, let's look at the next slide, which rather crudely shows us the extent of the territory if you read the Genesis promise. And of course, this oval is just an approximation. But if you look, Damascus is right about in the middle from north to south. And so you can see there's a lot of land that the Israelites had been promised, but they're not living in it yet. And so that leads us to ask, perhaps, how could this passage say that the Lord gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give to their fathers? I mean, how could it say that, knowing that they're only occupying what looks to be about maybe a little more than half of it at this point? Well, there is a response to that, I think, and it's this. I think we can say that the Israelites understood full well what God had promised, and they understood that the promise had been fulfilled. They knew that their enemies had not been completely driven out quite yet, and they knew that they had not yet occupied all of that promised territory. However, they also knew that God had given that land to them. They knew that at this point. They knew that he had done that and that it was now up to them to finish taking the land over with his help. And they understood that if they remained faithful to God, that he would help them do that. And in the end, eventually they would be living in all that land. Okay, the first question I had for you today was, what is the relevance of Joshua 21, verses 43 to 45, to the current ongoing territorial dispute over Palestine, this big beef that we've seen in the news as long as I can remember? And it goes back a lot longer than I've been alive, but it's certainly in the news today. And there are those, well, let me give you the short answer. And the short answer is it's not relevant to the dispute that we see in the news today. Even though a lot of Jews, probably just about all Jews, quite a few evangelicals, whatever that term really means, and many people in denominations say, they generally disagree vehemently with my short answer here. So let's move on a little bit. We note that the statements in the passage, in the Joshua 21, verses 43 to 45 passage, are plain. The statements in the passage plainly say that the land promise has been fulfilled. It says that God gave to Israel all the land that he swore to give their fathers. The Israelites took possession of it. They did settle in it. And the passage says that not one word of the promise had failed. We won't look at those other passages I have on the last line of the slide, but those just confirm God's carrying out or fulfilling the promise that he had made.
Ashley?
Yes?
There's another promise that was made, and that was if they fell into idolatry, that the Lord's anger would be kindled against them, and they would fail in their possession of that land.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We'll come to that later today in some detail, but you're absolutely right. And that's another problem for people who disagree with my short answer here, I guess. But as I said, there are a lot of people today who just disagree with my point of view on this, and they argue that the land promise has still not been fulfilled in its entirety. And when they make that argument, I think we can see they have to blatantly contradict plain statements in Scripture. But nevertheless, they do try to make the argument. Premillennialists argue that the land promise remains unfulfilled, and that they're always trying to look at current events and try to derive some meaning from them toward the fulfillment of this promise. As I noted, a lot of Jews don't believe it's been completely fulfilled yet. Many others don't. But again, the problem is that the text plainly says that the promise was fulfilled. And that is just a bottom line problem that I don't think they can get around at all.
Ashley?
Yes, Rod.
Yeah, one of the great themes of the Old Testament, in my mind, is the faithfulness of God. And this is one of those places where we see that being explained. Some of us that are older remember in the 60s and the short wars that occurred between Israel and their surrounding nations. And Farrell Jenkins had put together a series that dealt with the idea of whether or not the promises were kept that God had made and whether or not there was relevance, you know, in our age. So I think you've given the exact answer. But we saw, some of us remember, how brief those skirmishes were. And it's a part of the politics to understand the region and to understand what has been going on there.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Farrell, because I used an article he wrote about this in preparing for today. And I thought about sending everybody a copy of it just as an attachment to the questions. In the end, I didn't do that, but maybe I will next week or the week after. It's just a short 3-page article, but it makes the point pretty plainly, I think. And yeah, I'm old enough to remember the 60s. And the big one I think of is that 1967 war, which was just amazing, the way the Israelis took care of the Egyptian Air Force literally in a couple of hours. And I could talk about this stuff on and on, but I better stop. Well, as Barry noted, the Israelites later are going to lose the land. But it's not because God didn't keep his promise. They're going to lose the land because of disobedience and unfaithfulness. But let's move on to chapter 23 in Joshua. And here we're going to find Joshua making a speech or giving a charge to the leaders of the Israelite nation. And the chapter starts out by noting that a long time had passed with Israel at peace, and Joshua is now pretty old, and he's near the end of his life. We don't know how long that long time is, but I take it to mean quite a few years. And so he's going to exhort these Israelite leaders, and he's going to start off by reminding them of what God had done for them. And we see that in the first couple of verses, really in verses 3 through 5, he reminds these leaders about what God had done with the nations all around them, and that he had done it for their sake. And he reminds them that they had actually seen these things happen. This should be powerful evidence in their minds. And then after that, after laying that foundation of reminding them of what all God had done for them, he moved on to give some very important advice. And the second question I had for you this week was, what advice did Joshua give to these Israelite leaders in Joshua 23, verses 6 to 16? And that's rather a long passage, so we're not going to read the whole thing. I'll just make some reference to some of the verses in it in a moment, but he had a lot of advice for them there. And really, I think you could sum it up by saying that he exhorted them to be obedient to God. But let's look at first some of the things he told them to do. Does anyone remember the specific admonitions he had for them with respect to what they really ought to do? Well, he told them in verse 6 to be very strong in keeping to the law, that they should not deviate from it in any respect. There's an argument implicit, I think, in verses 7 and 12 that they should continue to drive out the remnant of these nations remaining among you. That language comes from verse 12, I believe. In verse 8, he tells them to cling to the Lord your God. And in verse 11, he tells them to be very careful to love the Lord your God. Well, he had some things that he told them not to do also. Anyone recall what some of these might be? It's pretty much the same thing we've been seeing over and over again in God's instructions, to Moses, and Moses conveying those to the people, and God speaking with Joshua early on in I think the early chapters of Joshua. None of this stuff should be new to us, but he tells these leaders in verses 7 and 12 that they should not be mixing with these nations remaining among you. He tells them in verse 7, do not even mention the names of their gods, much less serve them. He tells them, don't turn back and cling to the remnant of the nations remaining among you. And whatever you do, don't marry people from these local tribes or nations. In fact, do not associate with them in any way. He tells them these things in no uncertain terms. And again, there's nothing new about this. And then he also had some warnings for these leaders. And these warnings, when you read through them, are a little bit repetitious. And I think that was because he viewed them as being so important. They all stressed the danger that the Israelites were going to lose the land if they were disobedient. And he drove home that associating with these remaining Canaanites would mean that God would not help them anymore in driving the Canaanites out of the land. And that if they violated their covenant with the Lord by serving other gods, that would result in their losing the land. And again, that's the same warning that Moses had given repeatedly in Deuteronomy. So again, all of this amounted to an exhortation to be obedient to God. That's really what it distills down to, I think. Follow the law. Be obedient. Don't associate with the locals. And their well-being and even their keeping the land is going to depend entirely on their being obedient. That's made plain. As I read through this, it seemed to me that you cannot escape the conclusion that Joshua definitely perceived a significant problem that the people had. He knew, or at least suspected, that quite a few of them were already breaking their faith with God. And note in chapter 23, verse 14, Joshua says exactly what the text had said earlier at the end of chapter 21. In Joshua 23:14, Joshua said that not one word has failed of all the good things that the Lord your God promised concerning you. All have come to pass for you. Not one of them has failed. And he tells them he's about to die. He's getting close to the end of his life. And so that marks the end of a couple of major speeches or addresses. This one to the Israelite leaders. Moving on to chapter 24, we're going to find another speech. And in this one, he has gathered all the tribes of Israel together at Shechem. He's gathered them as a nation. Not just the leaders, but apparently all the people are gathered there. And he's going to give them some very, very important words of advice, much as he had just done with the leaders. How much time do we think might have passed between these two speeches, between the time he made his remarks to the Israelite leaders and now in this speech we're about to look at to the nation as a whole? It seems that perhaps not too much time had passed. We're not told. The text doesn't tell us how much time had gone by, but recall that he had told the leaders in chapter 23 that he was near the end of his life and he was about to die, so I figure there couldn't have been too much time between these two speeches. However much time there was, one thing that is made plain is that the concerns he had expressed to the leaders in chapter 23, he still has those concerns, because he's going to express the same concerns to all the people. And what we have here is the final speech of an old man telling the nation the things that he really believes they absolutely need to hear. These are going to be important things. Why did he do it at Shechem? Well, again, we're not told. So I sometimes like to speculate, so I'll do a little of that here. It could have been the central location, a convenient place to draw all these people together. Could have been the acoustics. Remember, this is where shortly after Jericho and Ai, the nation had gathered. They had those two mountains with a natural bowl or amphitheater between them, and he had been able to address the entire nation. So maybe that had something to do with it. It also, to me, had a little bit of a bookend feel to it, because again, that's where they had gone shortly after Jericho and Ai, and that's where the entire law had been read to them. Remember that, including the blessings and the curses. And now he has all of them together again at that same place at the end of his life to make his closing remarks to them. And he starts out explaining to them, giving them reasons why they, the people of Israel, should obey the Lord. Question three this week was, I asked you, what was the main argument that Joshua conveyed to the people of Israel, to the entire nation, in these verses, Joshua 24, 1 to 13, as to why they should obey the Lord? I know that question is kind of vague, so it's not easy to answer, but I see a definite argument there, and I'm gonna note the same argument structure in a couple of these speeches in a few minutes. Dan?
Well, I think it goes back to what Rod was saying a little while ago, that so much of the Old Testament is pointing to one central idea, which is the faithfulness of God to his promises and his people. And above all else, at least you can put it in those terms. It may not be exactly the terms you're about to use, but you can at least put it in those terms that his argument is, God has been faithful to you. Now it's your turn to return the favor when I'm out of the picture.
Yeah, that's not the exact words I've used, but it's the same idea. I'll go to what I had. I had another short answer on this one. And the short answer was, you should obey me because of all that I, the Lord, have done for you. These first 13 verses are a recitation of the things that he had done for the nation. And what does he do in those verses? Well, he sort of goes through a recitation of their history. He recounts the Israelites' history from his perspective, with Joshua conveying his words. And that's something that's worth noting. Before I go further into this, this argument is not Joshua's argument. This is coming from the Lord himself. If you look at Joshua 24, verse 2, we see there that Joshua is relaying words from the Lord himself in setting this up. And so, again, this is God saying this. God recounts their history. And he reminds the Israelites of this history, going back all the way to Abraham's father, Terah. And he gives them a list of highlights, the great things he had done for them. And at the end, he summed up, noting that, I gave you a land on which you had not labored, and cities that you had not built, and you dwell in them. You eat the fruit of vineyards and olive orchards that you did not plant. That's the situation now, at this point in time, as he's speaking to them. They seem to be living the good life. They're living in these cities that they just have walked into, with all the houses and buildings still standing. They are using farms that are well established, and they are living well. That's the situation. And the point of all this, I think, is God is saying to them, you did not conquer this land on your own. I've been with you, and I've been helping you through this whole process all along. And again, what this is a powerful argument of why they should obey the Lord. Look at the very next verse. I'll put it on the screen. Very next verse after that, after reciting all these things that the Lord had done for them, Joshua says, now therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. put away the gods that your father served before the river, beyond the river, rather, and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. Notice that word, therefore, that I've highlighted in yellow there. It's important, I think. Ivy and I, when we were living in Washington, were blessed to know a really, really fine, dedicated Bible teacher, and we came to just love the guy. Sadly, we knew him only a short time. Cancer took him away. But one of the favorite things that he liked to say in teaching Bible classes, he would say, when you see therefore, ask yourself what it's there for. And so let's do that in this case. Here, as Joshua begins to talk about serving the Lord, I think that word therefore is pointing back. It's pointing back to the first 13 verses. It's pointing back to the list of things that God had done for the people of Israel. Because of what was just stated in those first 13 verses, Joshua is saying that is why they should serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. So, you know, thinking back, he had used the very same argument, this very same point with the leaders. He had started out, I think, in verses 3 to 5 of chapter 23, of reminding them of what they had seen the Lord do for Israel. And now he's using the same structure here. And now I want to make a connection with something we did a couple Wednesday nights ago in Rod's class. And as I got to this material, I thought back to one of the questions that Rod had. And let's take a look at that. This is Rod's question number one from a couple Wednesdays ago now, July 28. And the question was, what was the first commandment Israel was given in Deuteronomy 6, verses 4 to 5? Were there reasons why the people of Israel should love God? Why would it seem significant that this was mentioned before he discusses the place that God's law should occupy in their daily lives? And if memory serves me correctly, we talked about that a little bit that night, and while I might wish that my notes were a little bit more extensive than they are, I was able to look back and see that we talked about the fact that love for God necessarily follows from what he has done for us. That was something that we discussed. God does great things for us, and that as a result of that, we should develop love for him, and that love should cause us to obey him. That was an argument that was discussed a couple Wednesdays ago, and I was struck when I was preparing for today that I was seeing the same thing here in these arguments made to the Israelite leaders and then to the nation of Israel. Both cases, this same kind of argument was made. The sequence was the same. God recounted things he had done for the people. And in each case, both to the leaders and now to the nation, the reminder of what God had done was followed with words of exhortation, of to love the Lord and to obey his law. Well, after relaying the things that God had done for Israel, Joshua spoke using his own words, and we find this dialogue happening between him and the people of the nation. And Joshua, in view of all that God has just said, he issues a challenge to the people. And really, this is going to be Joshua's last statement to the people, at least the last one that we have recorded. It's sort of his grand finale or magnum opus, however you want to think of it, I think. And here it is, kind of some of the heart of it here in Joshua 24, verses 14 to 15, a passage that's familiar to all of us, I'm pretty sure. In fact, quite a few of us probably have this plastered on our refrigerator somewhere. But let's read it. Now, therefore, fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods that your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day who you will serve, whether the gods your father served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Now again, the sense I get from reading this is that Joshua is aware of a real problem going on among the people. He knows, or he seems to know, that many, or at least quite a few, were serving pagan gods. He notes in 24 verse 2 that their fathers, including Terah, had served other gods on the other side of the river in Chaldea. Some of these idols had evidently been passed down through the generations, and they're still in circulation among some of the Israelites, even as Joshua was speaking to them. They had spent about, 400 years plus in Egypt, and evidently some of them had adopted some of the pagan gods found in Egypt. And now here they are in Canaan, and they've encountered gods of the Amorites, and some of the Israelites apparently are serving these gods as well. Well, Joshua tells them it's time to get rid of all these. You just can't do this. It's time for you to make up your minds. You simply have to make a choice, and I've made my choice, is what he tells them. So he lays that fairly powerful statement on them, and they respond and they state their intent to serve the Lord. And the next thing we have Joshua saying in response to their statement of intent to serve the Lord is this. He comes back at them in verses 19 and 20, and it says, "But Joshua said to the people, 'You are not able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you after having done you good.'" What do you think he meant by those words, "You are not able to serve the Lord"? I mean, is that something we should take literally? Barry?
Well, I think he was saying because of their idolatry, they're already not serving the Lord. And, you know, the witness that is set up is basically saying, "You've promised, but you're not doing it."
Yeah, I think that's right, certainly with respect to some of them. He can't be saying that none of them have the capacity or ability to serve the Lord. That can't be what he means. I agree with what Barry has said. It also could be that he was just trying to emphasize the seriousness of the promise that they had just made, to drive it home to them that what they had just promised to do was important, and the promise they had just made was important. It could mean that perhaps some of the people in their present state of mind were actually incapable of serving the Lord. And that has to do with what Barry noted, I think. Josh?
I think my way of reading through this, Joshua has a very wise perspective in that not only is he saying what they should do, but he's also deciding right then, right there, what he's going to do. And he makes that a conscious decision. It's already decided, and his choices from there will be reflected on that. I think in this particular point, he's making the point that you're not able to because you have not done that. You have not put it in your heart that God belongs here, and you're not going to make the choices because of that.
Yeah, and I think it all stems, again, from the concern he has. He has seen pretty powerful evidence that some of the people are unfaithful. And so it goes on. The people again say, "No, but we will serve the Lord." They try to reassure Joshua. They again say they're going to serve the Lord. And then Joshua says, "You are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen the Lord to serve him." We see that in verse 22. Now again, he had reason to doubt. He knew of the history of their pagan worship. The people again say, "We are witnesses." And so Joshua then says in verse 23, "Then put away the foreign gods that are among you and incline your heart to the Lord, the God of Israel." And I note that this is something that he has said more than once. He said it over and over again. Why do people repeat statements in that way? They do it to emphasize them. They do it because they think it's an important point, and surely this was. And so the people wind up saying in verse 24, "The Lord our God we will serve, and his voice we will obey." So the people have definitely made their pledge to serve God. And so again, I want to circle back to that argument structure that we saw a few minutes ago and just try to drive it home. We saw it on Wednesday night a couple weeks ago. We see it in the statement or the speech to the Israelite leaders. We see it again in Joshua's speech to the nation. And the argument sets up in the following way. It starts out by reciting what God has done, thinking about what God has done. The next point is that that should lead us to love of God, which in turn should result in our obedience to him and wanting to serve him. That was the argument that was made repeatedly. So what has God done for me? What has he done for you? If we don't have to think too long to come up with answers to that, but we, I suspect, need to think about it. I know I do more often than I do. And I think if I would spend more time thinking about what the Lord has done for me, it could well be, I think it would be, that my love for God would increase. And in turn, that would cause me to want to follow what he's laid out for me in his word. Well, Joshua, I guess to drive home the significance of all these back and forths with the people, made a covenant with the people, and he wrote the words in a book of in the book of the law of God, we're told. And then we have a brief recitation of three burials, Joshua and the high priest, Eleazar, and the bones of Joseph. And we'll look ahead now. I want to close out today, and plainly I'm not going to finish what I have in mind for us to talk about with my question four. And so as we started this week with the tail end of last week, we'll start next week with the tail end of this week, I think. But talking about their transition, the Israelite people, Joshua's about to die. This is going to be a major transition. He and Eleazar, we'll pick it up next week. Thank you.